I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. J. Richard Gott writes in his new book, and I'm quoting here, "The neighborhood children think I have a time machine in my garage." Well, it's not quite that simple, but the Princeton astrophysicist is no stranger to the fantastic notions of time travel in the imagination. His challenge is finding the solutions that can make the fantastic real. Gott is fond of reminding doubters that when H.G. Wells published The Time Machine in 1895, most people were convinced that heavier-than-air flying machines would never get off the ground. According to Gott and other leading physicists, time travel is possible. Einstein's theoretical universe allows for it, and Einstein's theories left a trail for the experts to follow. Their work ranges from the most fantastic to what physicists call the most basic, the search to understand the origin of the universe. And thinking about time travel brings us to the question some of our most unquestioned underpinnings of life lived in the linear way. Is time reversible? Could you shake hands with yourself in the past and not alter the future? Finding the solution, says J. Richard Gott, is just a matter of cost. Connection listeners, how do we reconcile our fantastic H.G. Wells notions of time travel with these real possibilities? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at The Connection, all one word, theconnection.org. I'm joined now in the studio by Princeton professor of astrophysics, J. Richard Gott. He's the author of the new book, Time Travel in Einstein's Universe, The Physical Possibility of Travel Through Time. Hello.
Hi.
I can be sure you're really here, right?
Yes.
Can I start with one of these basics? Because you talk about, let's talk about time, for example. When you talk about time, I think of my wristwatch, and when I look at it, I know that the second hand is going to go at 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. So can I depend on my understanding of time, looking at my wristwatch, as something which never changes? Is this a constant that I can base my understanding of time travel on?
Well, Einstein showed in 1905 in his theory of special relativity that moving clocks tick more slowly. And so this is a key to doing time travel to the future.
Moving clocks tick more slowly.
That's right.
If I'm walking down the hallway, my watch?
Slightly more slowly. Very slightly. It's all relative to the speed of light. Einstein had two postulates that he developed special relativity for. One was that motion was relative, and the other one was that everyone should see the speed of light as the same, 300,000 kilometers per second. And so if you built a light clock that ticked back and forth with a light beam bouncing between two mirrors, if you move that clock along very rapidly, if one passed me by very rapidly, that light, I would see it going on a diagonal path, and it would take longer between ticks. So I would see that clock ticking more slowly. And so that person, in order that he might not, again, motion is relative, in order that he might not think that he was special, then he would have, all these other biological clocks would have to tick more slowly as well. So he would age more slowly.
His heart would beat more slowly?
His heart would beat more slowly. And so we've checked this, in fact, with atomic clocks that were taken on airplane trips. If you go east around the world so that your velocity adds to the velocity of the rotation of the Earth, those atomic...
You mean holding an atomic clock in your
lap? They take it with them on the airplane trip. And when they come back, they compare it with atomic clocks that have stayed at home, and they're about 59 billionths of a second slow because they've been moving fast.
So this we know to be true. It's not theory.
That's right.
That moving...
Been checked many times by experiments, right. And particles that are moving near the speed of light, they decay more slowly and so forth. Been checked many, many times.
So how does that open up a possibility of actual travel within time as we understand it, let's say into the future?
Right. It allows time travel to the future because all you have to do if you wanted to visit the Earth 1,000 years from now is just get on a rocket ship, go at 99.995% the speed of light, out to a star 500 light years away, and then come back at the same speed. And when you get back, the Earth will be 1,000 years older. But you will have only aged 10 years.
hang on, if the star that I'm traveling to is 500 light years away,
right,
then in Earth time, my trip takes me
500 years to go, 500 years to come back. But my clock is ticking very slowly because I'm moving near the speed of light. So I only age 10 years. So when I get back, I'm 10 years older. And I'm visiting the world of 3001.
Well, then, good, it's solved. We can just do that now. obviously, the big wrinkle in this is figuring out a way of transporting matter at the speed of light, right?
Well, at nearly the speed of light, almost the speed of light.
Okay.
I mean, we send protons in our particle accelerators at speeds that fast.
What's a proton?
Oh, well, this is the nucleus of the hydrogen atom. It's a... one of the...
Can I see it, or is it...
No.
Microscopic.
Okay. And therefore, it's rather cheap to send such a small thing at that speed. And so sending people would be much, much more expensive. So it's a matter of primarily of cost. We know it's possible under the laws of physics. It would be very expensive. It would be fast interstellar travel. I mean, we've just gone to the moon, so... it's quite expensive in terms of the NASA budget, but it is possible under the laws of physics.
When you say possible under the laws of physics, does that mean the same thing as, yes, it's possible,
yes,
period?
Yes, right.
And this is the scientists in you talking.
Right.
I mean, if you were trying to make the case to NASA or someone that in fact, this is something we should be doing, isn't the amount of money that you're talking about, the translation of this speedy little proton into actually transporting a dog or a person in a,
yes,
in a rocket ship like that, such an unbelievable
absolutely
leap.
Yes, it's absolutely enormous. Because, but it's possible in principle. So a super civilization, you could imagine, might have interstellar travel. You know, interstellar travel is possible. Atoms in your body, there are atoms in your body that start off in other stars. So interstellar travel is possible. But taking a person there would just be more expensive.
And what's the argument, the scientific argument, for pursuing this? Because you're a serious scientist. You're not a science fiction writer. You
sure
have to make the case for money to run labs, to bring students in, to further for this science. So when you make the case, are you saying it's because someday you or your grandchildren may be able to travel in space, or do you use other arguments?
Well, I think in terms of relativity theory, we should remember that Einstein started thinking about rockets traveling at nearly the speed of light, clocks ticking more slowly, and he proved a lot of theorems from his postulates. And one of the theorems he proved was his famous equation E equals mc squared. So one of the things he got out of this basic research was E equals mc squared, which found application in atomic energy and the atomic bomb. So one of the reasons we do basic research is that you often cannot foresee what the consequences of it may be. So we're trying to understand the laws of by which the universe works, and it's important to understand that.
So can you, with one hand, grab together the theories about the start of the universe and the theories of time travel and put them together? Because that's where I have a hard time following you down a wormhole or up a cosmic string.
Right. The other question of great interest to theoretical physicists today is whether time travel to the past is possible or not. If you go nearly the speed of light, time slows down. So theoretically, if you could go faster than the speed of light, you could go back in time. In fact, there's a famous limerick. There was a young lady named Bright. She traveled far faster than light. She left one day in a relative way and returned home the previous night. So there's only one trouble with this. Special relativity tells you that it gets harder and harder to accelerate your rocket as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, so you can never quite get there. However, Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is his theory of curved space-time to explain gravity, that theory says that you could beat a light beam by taking a shortcut. So we have the concept that Kip Thorne came up with of wormholes, where you could go to Alpha Centauri on the normal way. That'd be 4 light years to get there. Or you could maybe jump through a wormhole that get there in 10 feet. So you could beat a light beam by taking a shortcut.
Was this the sort of thing that we saw in the film Contact based on Sagan's book?
Yes. In fact, Carl Sagan suggested this plot that he had in mind for this science fiction novel and movie later to Kip Thorne and said, have I got the science right? And so Kip Thorne investigated wormholes and found out that the problem was to prop them open, and there was a quantum effect that you could use to prop them open. And then he found out that you could use these for time travel to the past. So he did this in 1988, and it was stimulated directly by Carl Sagan's science fiction. And then I found another solution to Einstein's equations in 1991 with two rapidly moving cosmic strings that would allow you to circle them and come back to where you started and shake hands with yourself as you started the trip, you see.
I mean, it strikes me as a little bit fantastic that the people who work in the realm of science fiction, of the imagination, end up in certain cases being the ones who lead the more practical scientists. I would have thought it was the other way around.
Well, there's an interesting interaction both ways. A lot of times you'll see a scientific discovery like working with DNA, for example, leading to Jurassic Park, you know. So it's a two-way exchange, I think.
In your book, you say that it's a lot harder to go into the past than into the future.
Is
it simply based on the fact that you have to go faster than light, or is it because going into the past raises all those questions about interfering with what is yet to take place?
Well, yes, there's... Einstein's theory allows solutions that are sufficiently twisted so that you can go, you're going always toward the future at each point. But when you travel around, you find yourself back at the event where you started, your time and place of departure. And so this is quite like when Magellan's crew went around the Earth. They went west, 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 and eventually found themselves back in Europe. And so there's various problems with doing this. For example, your wormhole you have to prop open. You have to be careful that quantum effects don't spoil your chances, a point that Stephen Hawking has raised. And also, if you do the cosmic string thing, you may end up being trapped in a black hole, not able to get out, and so forth. So it's harder to go into the past, and we're trying to ascertain whether that's possible.
Connection listeners, how do we reconcile our fantastic notions about time travel with the real physics of it? My guest is J. Richard Gott. His book is Time Travel in Einstein's Universe. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
Dudes, you guys are going to go back in time.
Yeah!
You are going to have the most excellent adventure through history.
Who are you guys?
We're you, dude!
No way. No way.
Yes way, Ted!
Look, we know how you feel. We didn't believe it either when we were you, and we us said what we us are saying right now.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. J. Richard Gott writes in his new book, and I'm quoting here, "The neighborhood children think I have a time machine in my garage." Well, it's not quite that simple, but the Princeton astrophysicist... Wait a minute. I already said that. That was the beginning of the program. Now what are you listening to? Partway through the program, or are we back at the beginning? It's the Groundhog Day notion of moving through time, going to sleep, waking up, finding out it's the same day all over again. Again, it's this, J. Richard Gott, the notion of popular culture exploiting the kind of ideas that you're offering or giving you the ideas.
Right. Groundhog Day movie is based on a space-time that's like a sheet of paper. If you have time going vertically and space horizontally, you could draw your path through time as a straight line going from the bottom to the top of the sheet of paper, going toward the future always. But you could then take that piece of paper and bend it into form a cylinder and
a
tape together.
Vertical cylinder.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, a horizontal cylinder.
Okay.
Take the top of the paper and rotate it around and
so time's coming
match
back
it
down.
To the bottom.
Yeah.
So now you go around a circle. And so in the movie Groundhog Day, you keep coming back to the same day over and over again.
And a few minutes ago, we listened to a clip from the film Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, where Bill and Ted are meeting each other back in time.
Yes, that's an example of a science fiction story where they've been very careful to show a self-consistent picture of the space-time. So you'll hear that conversation when Bill and Ted are meeting Bill and Ted from the future, and then you hear that conversation later in the movie when Bill and Ted actually go back in time to meet their former selves, and of course it plays out exactly the same way as it did before, because it's one event, you know. So this is the conservative view of attacking what's called a grandmother paradox. What happens if you kill your grandmother? And the conservative
you go back in time and kill your grandmother.
Yeah, suppose you kill her and before she had your mother, then how were you born to go back in time and kill her? And the conservative answer to that is, well, the time travelers don't change the past. They were always part of it. So you might go back and have tea with your grandmother, but you won't be killing her because you couldn't have done that.
You won't be allowed to.
You won't be allowed to. Yes, that's right. Now, there's a radical view that says that, by David Deutsch, that says that there's this many-worlds theory of quantum mechanics where there are many parallel worlds going on, like railroad tracks in a railway switching yard. And so then the time traveler in that picture might go back, kill his grandmother, and then cause the universe to branch off onto a new and different branch where there's a dead grandmother and a time traveler. But the branch that we remember where the time traveler was born, well, that branch still exists.
Which means that if you bend a butterfly's wing back in time, you're creating a new... There's an infinite number of splinters of the past that you could follow.
That's right. And so physicists are divided about whether that many-worlds theory of quantum mechanics is true or not. And one of the interesting things about time travel research is it touches on some very basic issues about how the universe really works.
I want to close with that, but I also want to let our listeners in on this because we're getting a number of calls. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And JD is on the line. Hi, JD.
Hi, how's it going? Can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine.
Okay, a couple of questions. This is all very practical, I'm so sure, on paper, but there's some really real-world concerns that I'm concerned about. Number one, if it takes tremendous energy to accelerate something the size of a proton to close to the speed of light, how much more energy does it take to accelerate something the size of the mass of a spaceship? And then once you get it there, how in the hell do you stop it? Number two.
Hang on. Let's do it one at a time because it's a question that I'm puzzled about as well, and I want to understand the answer. So stay with us, JD. We'll get Richard Gott to weigh in on that one.
Well, basically, the energy requirements are in ratio to your mass versus a proton's mass, which is enormous. There have been various suggestions for how to do rapid interstellar travel, and so these involve some combination of either using a matter-antimatter rocket or using laser light sails. So you could put a big mirror out there on your spaceship and take an enormous laser in the solar system, shine at this, and this would propel it away from the solar system. You could use a matter-antimatter rocket to slow you down at the to stop you at the other end, and you could then use a matter-antimatter rocket to accelerate you back toward the Earth, and then the laser again with another mirror to slow you back down. So there have certainly been discussions of ways to do rapid interstellar travel, but they are very expensive.
JD, you had a second question.
The second question is, being biological entities like we are, being in close proximity to the kinds of energy fields that would be required to accelerate things to this level, and the kind of energy fields that are associated with wormholes, black holes, etc., and phenomena of this kind, X-rays, gamma radiation, how could we possibly protect ourselves from this kind of, like, energetic phenomenon?
Okay, good question. J.D., thanks for calling in. J. Richard Gott, there's another one for you.
Well, you just have to build in enough protection, and protection weighs something, too. So that makes the project more expensive also. So I think an interesting analogy here is that people originally said that it was impossible to for people to travel faster than the speed of sound. We're talking about speed of sound here, not the speed of light.
Right.
And so when you crack a whip, why, the tip of that whip, when it cracks, the crack you hear is a little sonic boom that's created when the tiny little,
little
end
tip
of that
of letter,
tip
yeah.
Goes faster than the speed of sound. So once you know that that's possible, then you say, well, maybe we could build an airplane that would take someone that fast. Same thing true when heavier-than-air flight. People should have known that was possible because birds do it. So getting an airplane the size of a 747 to do it is more expensive and more difficult, but it's possible in principle. So then you can go to work on it.
You go through life figuring out not that can't be done, but more how can that be done.
Right.
Telephone number at The Connection, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And from Louisville, Kentucky, Mark is joining The Connection. Hi, Mark. Mark, are you there?
Are you speaking with me?
I think I am. Are you Mark?
Oh, no, I'm Dan from Louisville.
Oh, Dan?
Yeah.
Okay, look, we'll let Mark on a little later. You talk now.
Well, I wanted to point out, I mean, the gentleman here is not really proposing that time travel is possible, is he? I mean, you're not really taking it serious, are you?
Oh, we're taking it seriously. Time travel to the past, time travel to the future.
Can I tell you why it's impossible before you go into the explanation?
Okay.
Because as we move through time, okay, materially, we are constantly changing, and we even have memory systems within our bodies, and even, you know, metals and composites and everything have memory systems that change and metamorphosize as they and we move through time. So we're actually changing in structure. Okay, as we move through time, so to go back in time, you will have to succinctly reverse all of these changes that are taking place. Now, I can see the relativity of time, you know, Einstein's relativity. I can see how we can slow down time in reference to how fast we move, or we can speed up time in reference to how fast we move, but I think, and I'm one of those people that, you know, in which the word cannot is not in my vocabulary. But this is one instance where I can see where time travel is impossible because as we move forward in time, we are constantly changing molecularly, if not atomically.
Dan, thanks for that. Let's go to the front of the class and hear what the professor has to say.
Well, what you say is quite true, that as we get older, we age, and we're different today and older, and various things get damaged, this increase in entropy and so forth. But when you go back in time, you're still going toward the future. You're not going back to becoming a baby. You're getting older all the time. But if I were to go back in time today, if I had the appropriate wormhole here now, I might go back to the year, you know, 1947, but I would be my current age when I got there. I'd be older than I was when I was born. So when in that story of Bill and Ted, when they met themselves, there was the older Bill and Ted who'd been on the time travel trip and the younger Bill and slightly younger Bill and Ted who had not. So when you go back in the past to meet yourself, you're older than you were before.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and Art is joining The Connection. Artie, are you there?
Hi, Did you say Artie?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is me. I guess based on the last bunch of questions, my question's rather mundane.
Those are the ones I can understand, so go for it.
Well, I'd heard that the biggest problem with traveling at the speed of light is that in order for a person to attain that speed, it would the ship or the vehicle would have to accelerate at a rate that in order to get to that speed before the person died, it would crush them. The speed of acceleration before, let's see, how can I put this, within one's lifetime, it would take too long if the rocket or whatever were to accelerate
slowly enough not to kill you, right?
Right, not to crush a person.
Right, that's a very good question. In order that, if you wanted to visit the Earth 1,000 years from now, if you wanted to accelerate so slowly that you would not find it uncomfortable, certainly a comfortable acceleration is 1G acceleration, which is what we experience on the Earth. So if you accelerate at 1G acceleration, it turns out that the trip, you can accelerate up to a high velocity near the speed of light and back down, visit the Earth 1,000 years from now, and the total trip, according to you, will take 24 years. So it's a bit longer than the 10 years that I described. If you don't want to be crushed, you have to go a bit slower, but it's actually possible in a human lifetime, 24 years.
You could go from zero to the speed of light without
flatlining. 99.99%
of
the speed of light.
I'm using it as shorthand.
That's right. You could get up to that speed and then come back down, slow back down, and come back to Earth, do all of that, and not have an acceleration worse than 1G.
What about it, Artie? Do you sort of allow yourself to imagine this, or do you get halfway down that path, shake your head, and say no? Never.
Well, the mechanics of it, I guess I don't. I just have had conversations with my kids where when they were younger, you know, I would snap my finger or something and say, and then 10 seconds later, we'd discuss what the difference is between that second one I snapped my finger and 10 seconds later, you know, we're both there at the same spot. So it was more esoteric than physics-based, but I do like to imagine it, and I'm hopeful that I could do it without being crushed. Thanks.
Thanks very much for calling in. You know, something occurred to me while I was talking with Artie. How do we know we haven't already met people who have traveled ahead and back in time to this space and this time?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Stephen Hawking has asked this question. He says, well, so where are the time travelers from the future? and there's a very interesting answer to this question. In the kind of time machine that Kip Thorne has talked about with wormholes, and in the kind of time machine that I've talked about to go to the past with cosmic strings, there's an epoch before which the time travel is impossible. In other words, you create the time machine at a certain point.
Yes.
And you can't use the time machine to go back before that point. So in layman's terms, if you invented the time machine in the year 3000, you might use it to go from the year 3002 back to the year 3001 because the time machine is there.
But you can't go back
to 2001 because the time machine wasn't there. So that would give a ready explanation for why we haven't seen any time travelers so far. No one's built a time machine to go to the past yet.
J. Richard Gott is my guest. His book is Time Travel in Einstein's Universe, The Physical Possibilities of Travel Through Time. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Joshua is on the line. Hi, Joshua. You're part of The Connection.
Hi. I was reading a book called Flatterland by Ian Stewart, and I was wondering, because the two main characters in the book, they go through a black hole, see themselves in the future, give themselves a time machine, go back, give themselves a time machine, and the time machine never leaves a time loop. I was wondering if that's a theoretical possibility.
Stay with us on the line there, Joshua. I'll get Mr. Gott to speak to that.
That's a little hard to gather from what you've said, but I think the kind of time machines that we have with a wormhole are ones in which you create the time machine at a certain point. you can get in and out of the time machine, and so the time machine, so to speak, doesn't go off by itself. But
and let's try and be specific, because when we're talking about time machine, my brain automatically goes to something that's square and made of metal and has, you know, Sherman and Peabody and the Wayback Machine. But in point of fact, we're talking about any number of ways of getting into a wormhole or traveling.
Yes.
Can you help me with that?
Well, these time machines, which are based on Einstein's theory of gravity, which curves space-time, which again has been checked by many, many observations, these are based on simply finding very twisted regions of space-time. It takes an enormous amount of energy to do this. The wormhole that Kip Thorne talked about, this would weigh maybe 200 million solar masses, 200 million times as much as the sun. So these are projects for, you know, super civilizations, so to speak. But they're all based on finding a very curved region of space-time where there's a loop that allows your path to circle back in time.
You use as an example in your book that this is proven by an astronaut who made up a few milliseconds, am I accurate, in his travel?
Well, yes, astronauts have traveled to the future. This is, for example, my friend Story Musgrave. He went up for about 50 days. He's about a millisecond younger than he would have been if he hadn't have gone. And our greatest time traveler to date is Sergei Avdeyev, who is a Russian astronaut, who went up for 748 days on Mir. And because of that, he is about a 50th of a second younger than he would have been if he'd stayed home.
Think about that. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Richard Gott. We're talking about time travel. And as I said, in case you didn't hear me the first time, you're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Here's a physicist who would tell you time travel to the past is not possible, Stephen Hawking.
The laws of science do not distinguish between the past and the future. Yet, there is a big difference between the past and future in ordinary life. You may see a cup of tea fall off a table and break into pieces on the floor, but you will never see the cup gather itself back together and jump back on the table. The increase of disorder, or entropy, is what distinguishes the past from the future, giving a direction to time.
That's the physicist Stephen Hawking from Errol Morris's 1992 film, A Brief History of Time. Richard, is there a point where you and Stephen Hawking differ fundamentally on this?
Well, yeah, Stephen Hawking has proposed what he calls the chronology protection conjecture. It's a conjecture, mind you.
Sounds like good defense, though.
Yeah, and this is the way science works. He has proposed this conjecture that somehow other laws of physics other than Einstein's theory of curved space-time, namely quantum mechanics is his hope, will step in to somehow stop you from doing time travel to the past, which Einstein's theory of curved space-time would seem to allow. And so then When Kip Thorne discussed wormholes, the debate goes back and forth. And Hawking said, well, there's this quantum effect that could stop you. And recently, Li Jingli and I found a different quantum state that didn't blow up and stop the time machine from forming. And so this is how we have this debate. There have been debates like this in the past. Einstein debated with Niels Bohr about quantum mechanics and stuff like this. So Hawking's, so that's just a conjecture, you know. So anyway, the comment that he made in there, I think, is interesting. There's what we call an arrow of time that makes a difference between the past and the future. A disorder increases in the future, which is what he referred to. If I shake a proton or an electron now, light waves will go out at the speed of light and get to Alpha Centauri 4 years later. But the laws of physics, of the laws of electromagnetism, are time symmetric. So it's always been a mystery as to why there's this asymmetry. Since the laws of physics don't have this asymmetry, why does the universe have this asymmetry? And so the idea was that it must somehow have something to do with the initial beginning of the universe, the initial conditions of the universe. There must have been a lot of order there somehow. It must have something to do with that. So one of the applications that we're interested in time travel is we have the picture today, and it's been checked with measurements of the cosmic microwave background radiation that we think that there's a period of rapid inflation in the early universe. And so the most common, the most popular...
This is the Raisin Bread analogy, that type of inflation?
Yes, the universe is expanding, but very rapidly. The inflation is just doubling and doubling again in size.
It's the idea that the raisins in a piece of dough get further away from each other as the bread rises in the oven, right?
That's right.
That's the type of inflation we're talking about.
That's right. And Alan Guth proposed this, and it's been checked recently with very exquisite observations of the microwave background left over from the early Big Bang epoch. And so it shows us that at that early epoch, the universe underwent a state of enormous expansion. And the most popular theory of inflation today is Professor Linde's of Stanford, where once you get one of these inflationary universes, it can give birth to other universes like branches coming off a tree. And so each branch grows up enormously until it becomes as big as the trunk and then sprouts further branches of its own. So you have this infinite fractal tree with an infinite number of universes that are spawned just as branches off branches off branches. And we, of course, would be one of the twigs out in there. But it does bring up the question, well, so where did the trunk come from? Okay. So, Li Jingli and I have proposed that, this can be explained if one of the branches simply branches off, circles back around, and grows up to become the trunk. So this makes a little time loop at the beginning, sort of like the letter six at the bottom here. There's a branch off, it circles back around, grows up to become the trunk. So in this case, the universe literally went back in time to create itself, be its own mother. And so this is rather like a science fiction story of Robert Heinlein's, where a man went back in time a couple of times and, with the benefit of a sex change operation, became both his own mother and father. Okay, so this is a picture where there's a little time loop at the beginning of the universe. And the only way to make that model self-consistent, you know, that you don't kill your grandmother and so forth, you can't have light beams going backwards in time down into this time loop, circling an infinite number of times. It would cause it to blow up. It would be like killing your grandmother. It would be not self-consistent. So the principle of self-consistency, that it's got to be a self-consistent solution, requires then that light beams only go toward the future, that if I do something now, it has effects later, and that entropy also, disorder would increase in this model. So
all across the United States, cars have pulled off turnpikes. Drivers are resting their foreheads on their steering wheels. What is that? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to Mark calling us from Louisville. Mark, are you there?
Yes. Hello, gentlemen.
Go ahead, please.
I have a question concerning the duplication of matter. I've never had a problem understanding time travel into the future, theoretically, because the matter that is within you when you get in the spaceship and travel and then come back was there in the universe and is still there in the universe when you come back. But if one were to go backward in time, wouldn't you be creating matter that didn't exist on the Earth? Because when you shook your own hand, there would be two of you, and therefore there would be twice as much matter in the universe as there was prior to your coming back into the past?
Well, you have to think about this four-dimensionally. You have a world line that is your path through space and time that goes from your birth all the way toward the future to your ends up with your death. In these models where you have time travel to the past, your world line simply curves back around and goes through the same event twice. So just like you could have two strangers walk into a room and shake hands, you're not creating extra matter there. You and your older self are just walking into the same room. So in all of these, we're not assuming that there's any violation locally of creation of energy out of nothing. It's just a peculiar property of curved space-time.
But in your example of the tree growing back around, the limb growing back into its own trunk,
right,
wouldn't you then create a tree without roots?
That's
true.
Like
a man with no mother.
That's true. It's so very peculiar, but the alternative is to sort of say that the universe spontaneously appeared out of nothing. And the trouble with that is that how does nothing know about the laws of physics? You have to start with some quantum state or something that knows about the laws of physics. You can't really start. It's hard to start with literally nothing. So this is a way for the universe to bootstrap itself into existence. It's peculiar, but something peculiar happened at the beginning of the universe. Perhaps this was it.
So you're saying that if you went back in time, you would not be creating more matter in the universe than existed prior to your traveling back?
No. You were always there. In other words, you and your Bill and Ted, when they met themselves, they were always there in the room. That event only happened once, and so there wasn't, Bill and Ted weren't there once without Bill and Ted in the future. They were always, the four of them were always there.
Can I ask you to ponder that a bit, Mark, while we move along to a couple of other calls?
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling in. 1-800-423-8255 makes the time travel connection. I want to know what they're putting in the drinking water in Louisville, Kentucky, because we've got another call. This is from Ted. Ted, go ahead.
Your previous caller raised another question in my mind. I'm a retired biophysicist, so you're a little out of my league here. But I saw an article one time that indicated that the speed of light in a plasma could exceed the speed of light in vacuum. Is that true, or do you know?
We haven't been able to get the transmittal of energy or information faster than the speed of light. Sometimes in a plasma, there's what's called the wave velocity, which may go faster than the speed of light. But the if you have a packet of waves that are going, the energy is transmitted at a speed slower than the speed of light. And that's the important thing.
So the waveform could go faster than the particle.
That's right. But the wave packet itself would be going at a slower speed than the speed of light.
Ted, thanks.
Okay. Could one quick question?
Go for it.
With the E equal MC square thing, and particles increasing in mass as they go faster, is there a point where you can get that mass to stick and generate a new particle?
Well, particles that go faster become more massive, and if they collide with something, there's extra energy to be generated. So you can generate sometimes in particle accelerators additional particles by taking a proton, let's say, and hitting it very high speed against another proton, and you'll generate lots of extra particles when they hit.
Ted, thanks very much for that call. My guest is J. Richard Gott. We're talking about his book, Time Travel in Einstein's Universe. And Richard, when you were speaking earlier about the theoretical differences that you have with Stephen Hawking. I was wondering, when you guys argue about this, I mean, is it like basketball fans arguing about whether or not Shaquille O'Neal's the greatest basketball player? You pound on the table and say, no, 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 or how does it...
Well, I guess sometimes people do. A lot of times people argue back and forth in papers. They'll write a paper answering another paper and so forth. So some of the discussion takes place in volleys of papers back and forth. You know.
And I'd just like you to kind of tie a bow on this for me, if you could, because there's a lot of branches out there. I mean, a lot of things you've left us to think about. Time travel is theoretically possible. Can you imagine a time when it will be done?
Well, there, it's more or less a question of what we will do as the human race. Our capabilities are enormous. But the question is, will we do it? We have just gone to the moon, that's all. And we could go to plant a colony on Mars or go visit Alpha Centauri, and these things are even more ambitious than that. The question is, you know, will we do that? And that's part of the topic of the last chapter of the book. The Copernican principle leads you to believe that you're not likely to be special. And so here we are, we're sitting on the Earth, and if human beings stay on the Earth, then you and I'll be quite typical. But if we go and colonize the whole galaxy, which we're smart enough to do...
But we haven't done.
But we haven't done, no. Then you and I will be very lucky to be on the home planet when almost everyone will be born later. So it's a warning to us that we might not accomplish as much as we're capable of doing.
Time travel in Einstein's universe with J. Richard Gott. Thanks very much for joining us. Mr. Gott is a professor of astrophysics at Princeton University and author of the new book, Time Travel in Einstein's Universe. If you're in the Boston area, you can hear Professor Gott read from his book tonight at Wordsworth Bookstore in Harvard Square. That's at 7 o'clock in the evening, Earth time. We had help today from Kim Bichari, Darren Manoogian, and Tim Monroe. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, Doug Sugarts, and Ben Walker. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. To continue the time travel conversation, you can go to our website. That's at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?